This month is somewhat devoted to the theme of concentration. One of the important concepts that goes together with the Buddhist teachings on concentration is encapsulated in the Buddhist Pali word that's pronounced viveka. And how viveka is to be translated into English is a little bit variable or controversial. And it's one of those words that perhaps should be left as in Pali. Just like many people like to prefer to leave the word dharma, dhamma, or dukkha. Dukkha is often translated as suffering. And people say, well, you know, that's too limited or too... It gives the wrong impression if you translate dukkha as suffering. So viveka is one of those words. It's hard to get an English equivalent. But some of the choices have been detachment, seclusion, solitude, separation. Those are some of the kind of words that are connected. However, the word also can have the connotation of sorting out, kind of like discriminating, sorting things out. The separation that the discriminating mind can make, it separates out one thing from another. Some of you might be familiar with this word in that Ajahn Sumedho, who's the teacher for Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano, his first monastery that he had in England, still there, the Pali name, usually we call it Chithurst, which is, I guess, the town it's in, or the name, the manor name. But the Pali name for that monastery is Achitta Viveka. And the word viveka again. And they translated it as, what did I have here? The mind of non-attachment. So they translate citta as mind and viveka as non-attachment. And this teaching of viveka could be seen to relate to a strong emphasis in the Buddha that each person should be an island unto themselves, or to be a light unto themselves, be an island. Be an island that no flood can overcome. There's a strong emphasis in the Buddhist tradition of becoming self-reliant. And a kind of self-mastery in the early tradition is a very important concept. Developing one's own capacities of mind, developing the kind of mind, the kind of heart, the kind of presence that is kind of like an island that can't be, you're not going to lose your stability by the vagaries of our life as we find it. There's a teaching... So this kind of teaching of kind of being independent, being self-reliant, being an island, being secluded or solitary, there's a strong kind of emphasis on this in the tradition. Now, in contrast to this, there's a very strong, it's a lot of Westerners feel uncomfortable with this kind of teaching. And I hear a lot of people have reservations when they hear this kind of emphasis. And so, in contrast, what you find in American spiritual circles, including Dharma circles, but it's kind of a pan-American, like, what century are we in? 21st century, 21st century modern idea of spirituality. I was in East-West Books today, and I just kind of glancing around, and I saw a number of kind of popular books that seemed to have kind of just generic spirituality. There was no grounding in any particular tradition, as far as I could tell. And the title had something to do with something like Become Connected or Being Connected. And the back jacket of the book talked about how alienated we are and how spirituality is all about discovering our connectedness to the world around us, to family, friends, whatever. And there's in Dharma circles also in America that we picked up this notion of being connected is very important. And people in the West often practice Dharma so they can feel more connected. And this is a very probably valuable teaching here in the West, because many of us have the notion that we're an alienated culture. And we're alienated from ourselves, we're alienated from others, and we're alienated from nature. And so it seems very helpful for us to have teachings and practices that helps us overcome that alienation. And so you don't want to go get a teaching that says become more independent and more solitary. You want a teaching that says, you can become more connected as a result of the practice. And part of this probably is the legacy of American individualism, which has a little bit that emphasis on becoming self-reliant and independent. And then so many people suffer because of it. And so we're trying to overcome the suffering that's built into this notion. We can speculate that in ancient Indian Buddhism, which has emphasis on seclusion, solitude, separation, and also the notion of home leaving. A monastic, a renunciate, was someone who left home, left the family behind. You didn't become more connected to your family, you left it. You can understand this perhaps, who knows why, but you can see that the different emphasis it had in kind of spiritual language and themes is perhaps because in the ancient Indian world, people felt burdened by their connectedness. They existed in a very tight family structure, very tight social structure, and a caste structure, and it was a burden. You know, you had your duties and your obligations, and there was all these limitations of what you can do because you were so bounded by the sense of connectedness that society provided people. And we can also speculate that those people who were in touch with nature didn't see nature as, you know, as John Muir did, but saw it, I don't know if it's fair to single him out, but saw it as a dangerous place. And often in some traditional cultures, nature was often a dangerous place and not necessarily a desirable place, not a place to go in awe and see the beauty and the wonderful sense of interconnectedness with nature. We were already too connected to the nature. That's why you wanted to, you know, hide from the tigers. You know, they wanted to be really connected well to you. And so, you know, you knew that they wanted to be connected. And so, you know, people were cautious. So there was a different emphasis then, you know, let's become, there's a burden in the excessive connectedness. You see it in some of the stories of nowadays in the paper about how some of the tribal, almost family dynamics in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And the sense of being an individual is very different from here in the modern West. And the family and the family pride and how you fit in the family structure and how what you do affects the identity of the whole family seems to take precedent over the identity of and the individuality of any one person. It's a very different kind of understanding of the human being. So if we can project that or speculate that it happened at the time of the Buddha, we understand a little bit in his context. The emphasis needed to be, the balance needed to come in teachings about seclusion and solitude and self-reliance, becoming independent. However, just today I was talking to someone. I talked about how incredibly burdened she'd been in her life by her sense of connectedness to the society around her and how she had lived her life trying to fit into the standards of what her employers and colleagues thought she should do and how she should live and what kind of activities she should do, what her family and her friends, what her Dharma friends. She saw herself through the eyes of how other people saw her. And that's a kind of, you know, very, was very painful for her to live that way. And she didn't really know what she most wanted. She'd been alienated from her own individuality because a kind of, we might say, neurotic kind of sense of connectedness, over-concern about how she's related to other people. So she was trying now to find for herself, you know, what does she want to do? What's the purpose of her life when she does away with all the kind of ideas of doing it for other people? Now, in Buddhist monasticism, which is often looked at as a model for what the Buddha had to say about the spiritual path. The idea of being solitary was a very important ideal. There's a famous rhinoceros horn sutra where the Buddha says you should go out and be like a rhinoceros. Rhinoceros apparently lives alone in the forest or wherever the rhinoceroses live. And you go off, you know, they're very kind of self-contained and, you know, no one bugs a rhinoceros. So you can be wander around the forest like a rhinoceros, solitary, alone. And monastics often, in fact, would go off into the forests by themselves and spend a lot of time alone. The Buddha spent a lot of time practicing alone. I don't know how much, but there are certainly records of him going off for 3 months at a time to be solitary and alone. At the same time, the monastic system was also very communal. Some scholars have said that the way the Buddha organized the Sangha, the monastic order, it was very similar to how the tribal republics were organized that still existed in India at that time. The Buddha belonged to one of these tribal republics that was where he was born into. And so the emphasis on community and being connected and social responsibilities and being in harmony with your fellow monastics was a very important ideal. And so this idea of being both independent, finding some ideal solitude, together with finding some ideal way of being in harmony with your community, both coexist in the early Buddhist tradition. It's not one or the other. Both are there. Both are important. And they don't have to be seen as being exclusive. They're just different domains of our psyche, perhaps, are being met or taken care of. So I like the word solitude as a translation for viveka. And I think that without solitude, there is no spiritual life. That's kind of my opinion. You guys are welcome to challenge that in your own ways. But I think that without solitude, spirituality is impossible. Our solitude is like a jewel that's encrusted and hidden by alienation, isolation, feeling of loneliness, fear, neediness, sense of obligation. And one of the great paradoxes is that how people often don't want to be in a solitary situation because they're afraid of being lonely. But aloneness can be one of the most precious experiences we can have in life. That's been my own experience, that I had very profound spiritual experiences that arose because of being alone. And I've certainly experienced loneliness in my life. And those are very different. But some people don't see them as being different. The idea of being alone is very frightening. Without solitude, I would argue, spirituality is impossible. Buddhist practice is impossible. And what we'll have to go into is the definition of what is solitude. Is it just simply being alone someplace in the forest? And there's other ways of understanding that, and that'll be part of the talk. And it could maybe be argued that without solitude, some sense of being at home in solitude, some ability to be alone in a way that you feel contented and at peace with yourself, that there is also no healthy relationships to other people. And I don't know if Rilke is an expert on relationships. However, Rilke wrote this, and I like this because of the way maybe because it resonates with me. So Rilke, the poet Rilke, wrote, "I hold this to be the highest task between two people, that each should stand guard over the solitude of the other. For it lies in the nature of indifference and of the crowd to recognize no solitude. Love and friendship are there for the purpose of continually providing opportunity for solitude." So that's a very, I think for some people, a very different idea of what love and relationship can be about. That it's all there to support solitude, or there can be no healthy relationship unless there's some ability to be solitary. And maybe simply you can see it that if there's a neediness, if you come to a relationship with a sense of neediness, there's going to be problems in the relationship. Can you really have real love if you're trying to fulfill your loneliness or protect yourself from fears or protect yourself from insecurity? Perhaps two people can meet in a very vibrant, full way and have really direct, unneediness kind of love when they've already found some way to be solitary and be content in that. There's no need. No neediness is being fulfilled in the intimate relationship. That, I think, is what Rilke is suggesting here. So solitude, viveka. The Buddhist tradition says that there are three kinds of viveka, three kinds of solitude or detachment, independent. I like the word independence because that's so good, works so well in America. The first is kaya viveka, and kaya means body. It's a bodily solitude, bodily detachment. And this is understood, the kind of solitude that we would think of more literally, of being going off by yourself and being by yourself, going off into the forests and being in the Sierras by yourself, or anywhere at all where you can be by yourself. You can be in your own house and have a period of solitude there. Some kind of period of aloneness. It's been, as I've already said, it's been those kinds of periods have been among the most rewarding times of my life to have had those opportunities. I've often talked, some of you have heard me talk maybe too many times about this, but it was such an important pivotal moment in my life was when I was about 21 years old and I was left alone on a small dairy farm in Norway. I was living there for some time, and the friends who ran the farm decided to somewhat take advantage of the fact that I was there. And because you can't leave a dairy farm very easily because the cows need to be taken care of every day. So I was there, so they went on vacation for a week. And so I was left there alone with these five beautiful girlfriends that I had, who twice a day I had to milk. And I loved my girlfriends a lot, and we had a good time. And I had no idea, I hadn't planned, I wasn't thinking that I was going to be alone. I had no desire to be alone. It never occurred to me to spend any real time alone. But they just left, and I was happy to take care of the farm. And it was in this kind of a little bit isolated valley off a fjord in Norway. And the only person I saw in the course of the week was, in the distance, I saw the mail carrier come walking up the long road, kind of deliver some mail nearby. Otherwise, I didn't see anybody. And while I was there, slowly, during those days, I noticed that my mind got quieter, and quieter is not the right word, but it became clear and clearer. And I became much more sensitive, much more observant to the working of my thoughts. So if I wasn't talking to anyone else. And so it was became much more intimate to the flow and stream of my thinking than I'd ever been before in my life. And also became the world around me became vibrant. I look at things and things just shone, kind of this vibrancy, this aliveness, this cleanliness of everything. And I got really high, really happy. And I kind of understood that it was probably had to do with being alone, and that I wasn't involved in social relationships, and social relationships are complicated. They're complicated for me. And all these concerns about how the people see me and what they want and how I should be and what I said and what they said and what I should say and, kind of sometimes muddle up the mind. And all that muddle kind of, because there wasn't anybody to talk to except these girlfriends. And these are very, uncomplicated girlfriends. And I had to go, it takes beautiful walks down this long, into the meadows and down the valleys to get them every day because they were out grazing. It just was a lovely time to be there. And then my friends came back and it all vanished. And to my credit, my quest for many years was not, how quickly can I go off and live by myself again? But rather it was, how can I learn to be alone together with other people? And that felt, because I didn't think that being alone was a reasonable way to live a life. But how can I have that sense of aloneness, that sense of having the mind unmuddled by fears and concerns and preoccupations about relationships while I was in relationships with people? And that was a task to find out. So it was very powerful to spend that time in solitude for me. Many people will find that's a wonderful place. Solitude is a wonderful time to find out who they are. Because sometimes we're so busy and so distracted with all the concerns and stuff that we live on the surface of our mind, the surface of our hearts. And solitude is one of those places where we can let things drop away and find out what's really making us tick, what's going on deep inside, what are our real wishes and concerns, what are the real things that we want our life to be about. So some people like to go off, all kinds of ways of doing that. Some people go off in a cabin someplace or just stay home for a week or sometimes just, there's all kinds of ways of finding. It can be solitude, 1 hour of solitude. It can be a week of solitude. It wasn't exactly solitary, but the 8 months I spent in Burma on retreat was a long solitary period. I had this little room. I just sat in this room by myself for 8 months. And I had interviews every day with a teacher and Dharma talk every day. But it was really, I didn't really talk to anyone for 8 months except for the interviews with the teacher. And I had this little room. I just stayed and meditated in this room and practiced there. And I had the sense it was just me and the universe. You know, just nothing between me and the universe. It's a tremendous sense of aloneness. What was it like to be alone, completely alone in the vast universe? That was kind of the koan, the understanding, the kind of thing that I was grappling with and trying to find, among many other things, in this period. 8 months of kind of a solitude. If you can't stand being alone, if you can't stand being alone in relationship to the mystery, then you can't become the mystery. So how do any of you relate to being alone? What happens when you hear the word, you know, being alone? Or someone suggests that maybe solitude is a nice thing to do, or suggests that you maybe try it out. What comes up for you? I've known people who've gone on retreats where they're not, you know, with a lot of other people around them, but just the retreats were silent, and they were really afraid. It happened to me. I told you that story. I mean, the first time I signed up for a sesshin, a 7-day Zen retreat, the first retreat everyone was going to do, residential retreat, I signed up. And then, but a week before the retreat started, I called up the Zen Center and said, something really important has come up and I can't come. And what I neglected to tell them was that important thing that had come up was fear. So there's this physical solitude, you know, actual, you know, what we usually think of as solitude. Taking your body and being someplace alone. The second kind of solitude is the name of the monastery in England, Citta Viveka, solitude of the mind. And this traditionally refers to, relates to concentration practice, and that's kind of why I brought it in this week, this month. When a person practices meditation, especially concentration meditation, there is a withdrawal from the normal activities, certainly of the world, but also the normal relating to the sensual world, the sense world, and relating to all the kind of normal neurotic compulsions that run our life. There's a seclusion from what's called the hindrances, seclusion from being interested in pursuing desire. Sensual desires, desire for sensual gratification. A withdrawal from being interested in engaging in thoughts or feelings of ill will or anger or hatred, aversion. There's a withdrawal from being engaged in the strategy of sloth and torpor, resistance. There's a withdrawal from the mind or the heart being restless or anxious, withdrawal from anxiety. You might still have the capacity of being anxious if someone says boo, but you withdraw yourself because of the state of concentration through various strategies from the possibility of the mind getting agitated. And you withdraw yourself from the possibility of having doubt. And partly this is a withdrawal. You're secluded. You separate yourself from what's called the hindrances. And partly this happens by out of a strength of concentration. If you're really concentrated on something, on one thing, then you're not going to have that energy of attention available for other things. So, you know, if you're reading a book and you're completely absorbed in the book and someone says something near you, even says your name, you might not hear it because you're so absorbed in that activity of the book. It's possible in meditation to be so absorbed in your meditation and being with your breath or being concentrated that you're no longer going to be interested in a lot of different things. You're not going to be connected to the sense world around you so much. Something really loud has to get your attention. And also, the strength of your concentration is going to lift you up above any interest to be engaged in sensual gratification. You're no longer going to have thoughts of sexual gratification that might have been bugged you in meditation for a long time, or plagued with the kind of incessant judgment or aversion that might come up, irritation or boredom. All these kinds of hindrances, you seclude yourself from them. Sometimes it's called an act of suppression, which is maybe not a very good translation. But I think the reason suppression is used is that it's understood to be temporary. It arises out of the conditions of your meditation. It's not because you work these things out once and for all. And in fact, once the concentration wanes, then all those tendencies can come back. So the mind is somehow, through the act of meditation, the mind withdraws itself from the normal activities that it gets engaged in. That's a kind of mental seclusion is cultivated. What this means partly is that we no longer let the mind race out in all the directions, all the preoccupations that it normally wants to get involved in. That fragments the mind, that irritates, and really it's a burden for the mind, really tires it out to be caught up in all these different concerns and activities. Even very pleasant fantasies in meditation that are very attractive because it's so pleasant and very, glorious, a kind of fantasy that can be about, can tire the mind in the long term. And so in the short term, this is really good and juicy, this fantasy. But when you see the cost of having your mind be there, it doesn't, why would you want to go there? So the mind gets concentrated. And in the concentrated state, there's a mental seclusion that's talked about. Part of the reason for developing a concentrated state is because in this mental state of seclusion, concentrated seclusion, there's a possibility of a deep happiness and joy arising within the system, within our psychophysical system. Very intense joy and delight can arise that has nothing to do with getting a massage or drinking alcohol or going for a run or going to the movies or eating good food or, I don't know how people get sensual pleasure, but a lot of different ways people get sensual pleasure. And it can be very intense, the powerful joy. Sometimes they talk about ecstasy and rapture sometimes, right? And great bliss, it comes in meditative states. Part of the function, and it's considered very important to have that very strong sense of pleasure or joy or delight in meditation, because it starts to recondition our inner life in a number of ways. One is it's very healing. If you've spent your life being anxious, and suddenly you have this experience to sit for an hour or sit for a day, just bathed in joy and delight and kind of this happiness that kind of pervades all your pores, it kind of begins reconfiguring your psyche a little bit. Kind of you finally rest and relax and feeling integration. And that can be very helpful and very purifying for some people to have that as an alternative. And in some way, it's kind of like thinking outside the box also, because some people are so consumed by trying to use their mind to figure out how to fix their problems and how to fix their anxiety. And to step outside of trying to fix it and rest in maybe bathe in this joy, in this delight, and let them kind of relax and heal, through the back door perhaps, is very, very helpful for some people. Also, it's very helpful to have that level of joy, whether it's mild or intense, because some of the things you have to confront in meditation, in spiritual life, are very challenging, threatening, difficult. And it's a lot easier to confront them if you have a sense of joy kind of behind you, a sense of ease and delight that's there to kind of meet it. Also, and this might not be very popular, but this is sometimes talked about, is that if you discover very intense, very satisfying, deeply satisfying, say it differently, if you can discover a more deeply satisfying joy or happiness or delight through meditation than you can through drugs or a sexual addiction or food, then you're going to be your addiction to those things might begin to lessen when you realize you have something a lot better. And then you might say, well, then I'll just get attached to that. It's just substituting one addiction for another. However, the addiction to the meditation joy helps begin to dissolve the attachments itself, including attachment to itself. So it's considered a way of beginning to loosen the tight grip we have sometimes on the normal places we want sensual joy and gratification. So this is a very unpopular one I'm going to teach now, to tell you now. But it's not so uncommon for people to come to me or to other teachers and say that the rapture they feel in meditation is better than any orgasm they've had. And it lasts a lot longer. And so suddenly, you know, if you know, most people, you know, the most intense maybe kind of physical joy they know is an orgasm. And suddenly you know something that's like a lot better. You know, well, what are you going to choose? Well, I don't know how you're going to decide that, but it might loosen up the grip, or the hold we have on certain kind of attachments. And that's part of the function of this very deep joy that arises out of this kind of seclusion of meditation. So it's a very important principle that what we're doing in meditation in part is withdrawing our interest in a lot of the things we're normally interested in, so we can get ourselves really focused and settled. It's not a very strange thing to do. I don't know how it is for most of you, but I remember when I took the DMV written exam, I was pretty concentrated. I wasn't very interested in other things for that half an hour, however long it took. I was there for that. Just I wanted to get it over with. So meditation is we withdraw our attention from things. We draw ourselves from the... And then as we get more concentrated, the meditation itself helps separate or create a solitude where the mind now is independent or detached from the thing, the forces of fragmentation. So the mind which is deeply content in itself is no longer then searching and grasping for things. In the Buddhist tradition, in the Pali and Suttas, it talks about someone who's attained this kind of concentration where the mind has attained solitude and is no longer plagued by the hindrances. It's described as being, now you're free of debt, you're out of prison, you are rid of a disease. It's kind of very powerful language. You're no longer in a prison when you're no longer being led around by the nose by the forces of desire and hate and ill will and anxiety, doubt. The third kind of viveka, of solitude, is that of, it's called upadhi. And upadhi translating to English doesn't make much sense. But it's the, I'm not sure how to describe it, when the mind has become independent without having to withdraw itself from anything in the world. So in a deep state of concentration, you're withdrawn from the world in a sense to get concentrated and enter this deep bliss. But in this last viveka, last seclusion or solitude, the mind now has become independent and the tendencies to grasp or to resist anything has been put to rest. And so you can be in the world but not of the world. You can be in the world, but you're not kind of entangled with the world. The mind has learned how to be disentangled from whatever's going on. The mind is made up of the mind is an activity. From Buddhist teaching, the mind is not a thing, it's a series of activities that work together or work in parallel. And those activities sometimes are entangled in our mind. And one of the things that happens as we begin becoming freer, one of the things that happens through meditation, is we begin teasing apart the different strands that make up the activity of the mind. And we can see that the strand of activity, which we call awareness, that which can be aware of things, can be independent of a thought that arises, which is a different kind of activity, or a feeling that arises. So you can have a thought of anger, and you can see it, but the mind is not interested in picking it up, getting involved in it. You can have a thought of doubt, or desire, or anxiety, or feeling of it. Those things can arise, but there's a sense that the awareness, the mind of awareness, the awareness of the mind, that strand of the mind, that you can rest there, and it doesn't have to be entangled with it. And our normal consciousness, awareness, and our thoughts are completely entangled with each other. We don't see them as being different. I call it, maybe not a very good word, but I call it the Teflon mind. You can have anger arise in your mind, and it doesn't stick anywhere, it just goes. You know, the mind has this equanimity about it, where just things arise, and it just doesn't, the mind is independent of it. The awareness is independent of it. So it's a kind of the detachment of freedom. Sometimes it's the analogy is to be like a grandmother watching children play some game, and the grandmother is interested, but is not caught up in the game, is not anxious about the game, is not invested in the children's game. She's seen it all before. So the grandmother watches with equanimity. So to be in the world and see it with equanimity, be interested in it, but not to be invested in it, or not to be burdened by what comes. To know the art of not letting things, let's say differently, the art of learning how to leave things alone. And the gift, or say it more literally, actually what happens in the mind, we learn the art of giving everything else its freedom. It isn't so much that we become free, which if it's all about me becoming free, I'm free now. Isn't that great? Notice, you all notice how free I am, and it's really important you tell your friends that Gil is free, and let me show you how free I am, and you know, it's all about me and mine, right? It's not much freedom in that kind of concern. It's not, freedom is not about you. Freedom is something you grant to the world around you. In this last independence or seclusion or solitude of the mind, you grant freedom to your friends. You grant freedom to your shoes or to the room or to the traffic or to your... You give freedom to your desires. You give freedom, not freedom to your desires in the sense of acting on them, but you don't bother them. You don't pick them up. You let them do whatever they're going to do on their own. They're free to do what they want. Our desires will then often self-liberate if you don't pick them up. So it's not about you becoming free. It's about you giving freedom to everything in the world that you encounter, including that which arises inside of you. And when the mind has that ability to give that kind of freedom to everything, and there's no tendency, no inclination whatsoever to have any stickiness in the mind, to be caught, that's called the seclusion of upadhi, the last seclusion, the seclusion of freedom. Yeah.
What's the difference between that and apathy?
It's a huge difference, because apathy involves a kind of resistance. Apathy is a stance, an activity, a posture that we take. There's an activity of the mind that causes apathy. It's usually maybe a judgment, maybe a fear, maybe resistance, a disinterest. There's a disinterest that we create. I'm not interested. Freedom. There's no movement towards being disinterested. There's no pulling away or resistance to anything. There's no aversion. Sounds frightening, doesn't it? Boredom is a doing. Boredom is a doing. If the mind is bored, the mind has picked something up.
And has aversion
in it. The frightening thing is that this freedom that the Buddha is pointing towards, this kind of, when the mind is really free in itself, it's not going to do you one bit of good. So why would you do it? I think it's your heart's deepest wish. It's the heart which is unbound. The word for Ajahn Amaro, when he was here this weekend, said that one of the words for important words in Pali tradition is Nirodha, which sometimes translates as extinction, which is a very bad translation, he said. But it's kind of one of the descriptions of what happens as a person becomes free. He referred to the etymology of the word, meaning the heart's no longer restrained. The unrestraining of the heart. And one of the things that restrains the heart, the freedom of the heart, is when we refer everything to ourselves. And that's why I say it doesn't do you any good. And most people don't want to go that far. But that's what the heart most wants. Even though your ego doesn't want that. Yeah.
Can you engage in something without desire?
That's a little bit complicated question, but the problem when Buddhists speak about desire this way, maybe the way I did today, shorthand, it seems like we're problematizing all desire. And the freedom is to see a desire as a desire, and then to have the wisdom to know which desires are useful to pick up and which are not. If you have a desire to go to the bathroom, it could be that's a wise, you know, especially if you're sitting on a nice, white, clean, new carpet. Please, you know. That seems like a good one. But if you're sitting here and you hear the wonderful bell, I'd like to have a bell like that at home. I think I'll just go home with it. You know, that's not a good desire. That involves probably some kind of clinging. So the issue in Buddhism is not desire by itself, but rather does desire come with clinging? And if it has clinging, then the person has lost their freedom.
Yes, but if something presents itself to you,
and
you pick it up, because it presents itself to you and it's almost like right action.
Give me an example.
Work. Anything that presents itself to me and I have a choice. Can there be no desire if I pick that up? It's...
Well, kind of. But maybe change the word to motivation. Okay. I mean, if we're going to make a choice, there's usually a motivation behind it. Mm-hmm. And that motivation can be unencumbered by any fear or resistance or hate or clinging. Mm-hmm. And it could be motivation to do something, you know, to do a thorough job. It can be motivation to help someone. There's a lot of things, a lot of reasons why we can be motivated. Some of that motivation can be thought out, considered, and sometimes motivation seems to just come out of the heart itself.
Like coming here.
Maybe.
You know, rather than putting a value on it, is it good that I come here, or is it not good that I come here? I come here, and so.
Is it helpful that you come here?
Pardon?
Is it helpful that you come here?
Yes.
So I prefer, rather than good or bad to come here, I prefer languages, is it helpful or not helpful? If it's not helpful for you to come here, you shouldn't come. Mm-hmm. It's wasting, you know, your time and our time. And yes? Not consistent with what?
Consistent with solitude.
Please.
Besides at the end, or something dead Japanese, is that firstly, is to stop burying your own countrymen. And at the end of the story, while his countrymen went back to Japan, he stays on and not only buries the leftover Japanese, but all the other rotting bodies, just immersed himself in this terrible task.
Sorry? Okay, so then I was going to continue. I think the end of the talk was going to be, in the beginning of the talk, I kind of made this distinction between American culture liking connectedness in their spirituality and the ancient Buddhist tradition emphasizing this seclusion. And then I talked about the different kinds of seclusion. And then the highest form of seclusion is that of a free mind, which doesn't withdraw from the world, can be involved in the world, but the mind, the awareness, knows how to rest in itself so that it doesn't, there's no stickiness, it doesn't pick up something unless it's useful to get involved. There's no clinging, no resistance, no contraction in the heart or the mind when things occur. So someone says to you, you know, your mother wears army boots, and you know, you're just kind of like, it's like the breeze blowing by, it doesn't, it's quite easy to let the mind be peaceful then, right? If someone tells you that, says, you know, they don't like your haircut, then, you know, some of us will get like, oh, that maybe got your little bit, your energy going a little bit. And then somebody says even more personal, they can, you know. But actually, a mind that's free is a mind that doesn't take anything personal, doesn't get troubled by anything. So that's the highest. Now, there are different perspectives and looking of a different perspective of talking about the free mind, the free heart. If you're looking inward towards itself, you can, if you like, describe it as being secluded or solitary, independent or detached. Independent works well for us, right? We like that better. If it's looking out away from it, then that awareness which is secluded or independent, which doesn't have a tendency for cling or contraction in it, is going to be a mind, a heart, which is much more sensitive to the world around it. Because there's nothing obscuring it. There's no clouds in front of it, and not so many. And so that greater sensitivity to the world around us, in America, we like to describe as being connected, being more connected to others. So it depends on which direction you're talking about. If you're looking inward, you can describe it as being a mind which is independent. If you're looking outward, you describe it as a mind which is more sensitive or connected to the world around it. And perhaps, in the very best ways of talking about this, the American ideal American Buddhism of being connected and interconnected, it's just a different way of talking about the same thing, same experience, as the ancient Buddhist tradition talked about becoming secluded, solitary. Now, many of us here in the West or elsewhere want to have our Buddhism be compassionate, something that connects us to the world and gets us involved in compassionate action. So it's very satisfying then if a teacher says, well, if you learn how to rest in emptiness, if you learn how to rest in the heart which is free and independent, it's the innate response of that emptiness to be compassionate. And that's kind of in my experience, that compassion is the response out of that. But I'm a little bit shy to say it, because then we have a reason for becoming free. And I think you can't become free if you have a reason. What's required of us, I believe, is a very radical trust in the innate intelligence that's here when we give up, when the mind doesn't cling anymore. And how that innate intelligence expresses itself, you won't know ahead of time. And it seems to often express itself out of compassion. But we shouldn't say that too often. I don't think we want... there's one tradition in Buddhism where you don't want to justify freedom because it helps you become more compassionate. Freedom justifies itself. Freedom is an end to itself. Compassion can be seen as a very important part of being a human being. And you trust then your human heart that it'll know how to respond. I don't know if that was how eloquent or how clear that was, but I hope it was okay. So I wanted to end with this poem by the Japanese poetess Izumi Shikibu from the 10th century. And again, I might have read this a few weeks ago. The moon is sometimes understood to be the awakened state, awakening. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I know myself completely, no parts left out. So can you discover that solitude that leaves nothing out, not even your neighbors? So thank you all very much.